As part of leaving Bloomington for college and my brand new start, I'd made a careful decision to never, ever tell anyone about my sister Fern. Back in those college days, I never spoke of her and seldom thought of her. If anyone asked about my family, I admitted to two parents, still married, and one brother, older, who traveled a lot. Not mentioning Fern was at first a decision and later a habit, hard and painful even now to break. Even now, way off in 2012, I can't abide someone else bringing her up. I have to ease into it. I have to choose my moment. Though I was only 5 when she disappeared from my life, I do remember her. I remember her sharply, her smell and touch, scattered images of her face, her ears, her chin, her eyes, her arms, her feet, her fingers. But I don't remember her fully, not the way Lowell does. Lowell is my brother's real name. Our parents met at the Lowell Observatory in Arizona at a high school summer science camp. I'd come to see the heavens, our father always said, but the stars were in her eyes, a line that used to please and embarrass me in equal measure. Young geeks in love. I would think better of myself now if, like Lowell, I'd been angry about Fern's disappearance, but it seemed too dangerous just then to be mad at our parents, and I was frightened instead. There was also a part of me relieved, and powerfully, shamefully so, to be the one kept and not the one given away. Whenever I remember this, I try to also remember that I was only 5 years old. I'd like to be fair here, even to myself. It would be nice to get all the way to forgiveness, though I haven't managed it yet and don't know that I ever will or ever should.
That is great. Thank you very much. Karen, early on in your novel, we learn that your narrator, Rosemary, had a troubled childhood, that when she was 5, her sister, Fern, disappeared for mysterious reasons, and her older brother, Lowell, became very angry. And at this point in the story, as Rosemary is telling it, she's in college, she's looking back at a number of traumatic events in her young childhood. How would you describe Rosemary at that point in the story?
At that point in the story, she is feeling that she has finally escaped her past. The things that happened to her in her childhood were fairly public things. So the town that she grew up in, which is Bloomington, Indiana, coincidentally, the town I also grew up in, the events, the things that happened in her family were well known, and they have defined her throughout her her childhood and her adolescence in Bloomington. So she has gone far, far away to college. And is trying to be someone new, someone be who she thinks she really is.
She wants to remake herself.
She kind of wants to forget
about this episode.
She wants to forget about this episode completely. She wants to meet people who will not immediately have those associations with her. But she also feels, as part of forgetting it, that there are things about herself that she needs to conceal. So it's a balancing act of, you know, wanting to meet people and wanting a fresh start, but also feeling that she can't really be herself as she does this.
So you've tantalized us with a few details here. We learned that there are these two sisters, Rosemary and Fern, of the same age. How would you describe the two of them?
They are, in the beginning of the book, described very much as twins, that although they are not, in fact, exactly the same ages, they are very close in age.
Mm-hmm. And what are their differences in personality?
Fern is the sister who was given away, is much more flamboyant, much more outgoing, much more filled with joie de vivre.
And more physically capable, too.
Much more physically capable. And Rosemary is sort of the chronicler, the person narrating their lives, and also the person who kind of explains Fern to people.
So Rosemary is the big talker.
She is a nonstop talker, yes.
And is sort of trying to explain Fern to the rest of the world, because Fern does not talk at all.
That's exactly right. And because Fern has so many other qualities in which Rosemary is deficient, Rosemary really has settled on the talking as the thing that she does, the one thing that she does better than Fern. And so she has come to believe that her talking is very valuable to the family and much enjoyed, although it's clear that it is much enjoyed, but it is also often quite wearisome to the people around her.
Now, at this point in our interview, I think we need to reveal a certain secret, which you do not reveal in your novel until about a third of the way into it, and that is that Fern, the sister, is a chimpanzee. And it is ingenious what you've
done because
you know, once we attach the label chimp onto Fern, we're going to think about her in a totally different way. And we don't know that for the first, 80 or 90 pages
of
the novel.
Of course, it was my intention that you meet Fern and think of her as a sister, which is the way Rosemary thinks of her first, and learn that she is a chimp only later for exactly the reason that you just said, that if I start off telling you she's a chimp, you are picturing the family in quite a different way.
So the conceit of the story is that this family, and the parents are scientists, the father is a psychologist at Indiana University in Bloomington, wants to raise a chimp as a human, basically a chimp of the same age as one of his own children. And there is actually, this is based on an actual historical experiment, right?
It is, yes. Quite a famous experiment, also conducted at Indiana University by a psychologist named Winthrop Kellogg. There are changes, of course. I have fictionalized everything. Winthrop Kellogg's experiment took place in the 1930s. The experiment in my book takes place in the 1970s. The Kellogg experiment lasted 19 months. My experiment goes on for 5 years. The Kelloggs had a little boy. Mine involves a little girl. The human child in the family is a little girl. But yes, I certainly got the idea from this experiment, which perhaps because my father was a psychologist at IU, I had just grown up. I can't tell you the day I was first told about this experiment.
So what happened in that early experiment from the 1930s? What happened to the Kellogg family?
Interestingly, I think, and unexpectedly, I did not know when I was writing the book that there was another child in the Kellogg family. I knew that the boy who was the subject of the experiment had died, and I did not know that after the experiment ended, the family had a little girl who is now, I'm guessing, in her 80s, but lives fairly close to me and has written me a few letters since the book came out about her family and about the experiment. So that's been fascinating. The experiment came to a pretty abrupt end because, you know, as it was conceived, it was all about how human the chimp might be if the chimp were raised exactly the way you would raise a child. You know, what behaviors might the chimp have? What capabilities might the chimp have? What appears to have been completely unanticipated is that having a chimp sibling of a similar age affected the behaviors of the human child. And the human child was actually very quick to take on chimp behaviors. And according to rumor, now confirmed by these letters I've been getting, apparently he began food hooting when his breakfast was put in front of him. And then the morning he did that, Mrs. Kellogg said to her husband, That's the end of this experiment.
They didn't want him to become Monkey Boy.
They did not. That was not the plan at all.
So one of the issues in your book is as Fern, the chimp, becomes an adolescent. I mean, chimps are very powerful creatures.
They are very
powerful. Sort of cannot be contained within a human household. And so then there's the real question of do they pose a danger to the humans, including in this case, to Rosemary, the young human girl.
Yes. Again, I think in the 1970s, when my book is set, certainly in the 1930s, when the Kellogg experiment took place, these things were not as clearly understood. I've read many books now written by people who were involved in home raising chimp experiments of one kind or another, and I take them at their word when they say that they believed they were making a lifelong commitment. They believed the chimp would be part of the family for as long as they, you know, everyone involved was alive. This has not turned out to be possible.
Why?
For exactly the reasons that you said, that the chimps become very powerful. They're not controllable. If you could imagine, you know, what it would be like to raise to have a 3-year-old with superpowers. I believe there have been movies written about this, you know, that there would just be, the landscape would be nothing but smoking devastation if a 3-year-old actually had the power to do whatever came into his or her head at the moment.
Sort of like the id runs wild.
Exactly.
And, you know, in a chimp, a 3-year-old chimp is physically very powerful. I mean, stronger than any human.
Yes. Well, it's really about age 5 where it becomes a problem. As the chimp moves into adolescence, all of these issues get much more difficult. The chimp gets much, much stronger, smarter. And, you know, I'm sure most everybody listening will know something about some of the horrific chimp attacks of the last few years. So.
Well, there was the one case where a woman had lived with a chimp for years.
Yes.
And seemed to have lived very well with the chimp. And then suddenly the chimp turned on her and mauled her.
Chimp actually turned on a friend who came to visit. I think the woman who lived with the chimp was still quite safe and, you know, much beloved by the chimp. But a friend who came to visit set the chimp off for some reason. And it was just a devastatingly tragic event that illustrates yet again why chimps are not, you know, are not to be kept in the house.
Now, much of the story is Rosemary, your narrator, is reflecting back on what happened. And she can't exactly remember all the details of when she was 5, when Fern was removed from the household. But various glimpses of this past life come back to her. And I'd love to have you read a passage where she reflects on some of the differences between Fern, her chimpanzee sister, and herself. Could you go ahead and
I would love this? To. Thank you. I always used to believe I knew what Fern was thinking. No matter how bizarre her behavior, no matter how she might deck herself out and bob about the house like a Macy's parade balloon, I could be counted on to render it into plain English. Fern wants to go outside. Fern wants to watch Sesame Street. Fern thinks you are a doo-doo head. Some of this was convenient projection, but you'll never convince me of the rest. Why wouldn't I have understood her? No one knew Fern better than I. I knew every twitch. I was attuned to her. Why does she have to learn our language? Lowell asked my father once. Why can't we learn hers? Dad's answer was that we still didn't know for sure that Fern was even capable of learning a language, but we did know for sure that she didn't have one of her own. Dad said that Lowell was confusing language with communication when they were two very different things. Language is more than just words, he said. Language is also the order of words and the way one word inflects another. Only he said this at much greater length, longer than either Lowell or I, or certainly Fern, wished to sit still for. It all had something to do with umfeld, a word I very much liked the sound of, and repeated many times like a drumbeat until I was made to stop. I didn't care so much what umfeld meant back then, but it turns out to refer to the specific way each particular organism experiences the world. I am the daughter of a psychologist. I know that the thing ostensibly being studied is rarely the thing being studied. When the Kelloggs first raised a child alongside a chimpanzee, back in the 1930s, the stated purpose was to compare and contrast developing abilities, linguistic and otherwise. This was the stated purpose of our study as well. Color me suspicious. The Kelloggs believed that their sensationalistic experiment had sunk their reputations, that they were never again taken seriously as scientists. And if I know this now, our ambitious father surely knew it then. So what was the goal of the Rosemary-Fern study before it came to its premature and calamitous end? I'm still not sure. But it seems to me that much of the interesting data is mine. As I grew, my language development not only contrasted with Fern's, but also introduced a perfectly predictable X factor that undermined all such comparisons. Ever since Day and Davis published their findings in the 1930s, there's been a perception that twinness affects language acquisition. New and better studies took place in the 1970s, but I'm not sure our parents were looking in their direction yet. Nor would such studies have been completely relevant to a situation such as ours, where the twins had such disparate potentials. Though Fern and I were sometimes separated while the grad students observed us, we spent most of our time together. As I developed the habit of speaking for her, she seemed to develop the expectation that I would. By the time I turned 3, I was already serving as Fern's translator in a way that surely retarded her progress. So I think that, instead of studying how well Fern could communicate, our father might have been studying how well Fern could communicate with me. That there was a vice versa here, a tabloid-ready vice versa, was unavoidable but unacknowledged. Here is the question our father claimed to be asking. Can Fern learn to speak to humans? Here is the question our father refused to admit he was asking. Can Rosemary learn to speak to chimpanzees? One of the early grad students, Timothy, had argued that in our pre-verbal period, Fern and I had an idioglossia, a secret language of grunts and gestures. This was never written up, so I learned of it only recently. Dad had found his evidence thin, unscientific, and frankly, whimsical.
That's a wonderful passage, and
so
suggestive because, I mean, you're really raising some profound questions here because perhaps we've never really studied chimpanzees the right way. I mean, trying to measure their intelligence by language studies because, of course, they don't have language as we do, but they can communicate in other ways. Maybe there's a whole different world of chimpanzees we've never really been able to figure out.
One of the startling things that I discovered when I was doing the research for the book along these very lines is how long it took in these studies of chimp communication for somebody to say, maybe instead of looking at how chimps communicate to humans, we should look at how chimps communicate to each other. It seems, in retrospect, like such an obvious point if you're interested in chimp communication. And yet we are so human-centric in our vision of the world and sadly, it looks to me, in our carefully programmed scientific experiments that it seems to me, that the results are almost always thrown into complete doubt by the way the experiment is designed.
Yeah. So what changes if we don't try to read this through the human lens? I mean, which is hard not to do, but if we really try to watch how chimps communicate with each other, I mean, what worlds open up then?
You know, worlds in which we acknowledge and recognize a kind of intelligence that does not resemble human intelligence. I think the process of researching this book was an interesting one because my interests got wider and wider as I read. And so I started out, very much focused on the home-raised chimps and then on primate studies in general and then on animal cognition, and which is just a very fast-moving and incredibly interesting field, I think. And I count myself among the humans. When I started the book, I was interested in chimps because their kind of intelligence is so similar to ours. And, mm-hmm. It was really only in the process of writing the book that I started to ask myself, what's so important about that? Why is an intelligence that is more alien to us not equally valid and equally interesting?
Can you speculate at all on what kind of intelligence chimpanzees might have? And I recognize you're a novelist, not a primatologist.
Thank you.
Where does that lead you? I mean, what do you think about?
I think about many things that that I discussed in the book. I think a lot of the questions revolve around a sort of theory of mind, which is whether chimps understand that they are dealing with other intelligent creatures. To what extent can you anticipate the mind of the person that you're dealing with or the chimp that you're dealing with? And again, these are very hard things to study. Whether chimps have episodic memory or not, whether they, whether they lay their memories in some sort of chronological way and remember that this happened before that happened, to the extent to which their memories reach.
And that's a fascinating question, which comes up in your novel, which is, Do chimps have long-term memories? Can they remember someone who was part of their lives maybe 20 years earlier, who they haven't seen all that time?
Yes. And I have had, again, you know, a number of people who have been home-raised with chimps have gotten in touch with me once the book came out, and also a couple of primatologists. So they have told me very firmly that, yes, chimps do remember 20, 30 years, you know, even after a gap, even after an absence like that, a human who was important to them reappearing will be instantly recognized.
I have to tell you that one time I interviewed Jane Goodall, and she said that...
What a thrill that must have
been. It was a thrill. And she said that she would have given anything to just be inside the mind of a chimpanzee for even a few seconds to think in that kind of nonverbal way, sort of imagining what it would be to think without language.
Yeah. You know, obviously we all experienced that at some point in our lives, but have no recollection of what it was like. And, you know, the extent to which memory also depends on language is another question. My mother, who was a nursery school teacher, was very, very interested in that kids at that age would occasionally tell her something that seemed to her like a pre-verbal memory, and she made a collection of all of those. She was fascinated by them.
Do you think we can think without language, outside of language?
I think that I can't.
Because you're a writer. So. Is that possible? Would we see that? Would we experience the world in a different way?
I think we must. A few years ago, I was asked to do some blog posts. I had a book of short stories coming out, and I was asked to blog on the website of the small beer press had brought them out. And I had been discontented with myself. I thought this was an opportunity to do something that I felt that I was deficient in, which was just actually paying attention to the world when I walk through it, that, you know, we've become so mediated, and I take a long walk every morning along the ocean, but I'm checking my heartbeat, and I'm checking my pace, and I've got music in my ears, and, sometimes I will come home sort of shocked at how little I remember of what I actually saw. So I thought, I will remove all of that. I will blog post about the moments of my walk, what I see, what I hear, what I smell. It will, you know, remind me to live in the world again as it actually happens. But of course, the knowledge that I was now going to put these into a blog post, that I was going to craft them in some way, that it was all going to go into language, was just a different kind of mediation. Mm-hmm. Although wonderful, it did improve the walks immeasurably, just to be looking around and paying attention and trying to decide what would be interesting enough for a blog post.
You still do that?
I do not. I cannot tell you the number of times in my life, starting probably when I was 6 years old, when I thought, I am going to keep a diary. I always last about six entries.
Now, the dramatic arc of your novel is that Rosemary discovers more about why Fern was removed from her family, and everything goes bad for the family. Rosemary herself is kind of a mess. She doesn't want to deal with this. Her older brother is furious about what happened. He becomes a militant animal rights activist, hunted by the FBI. Her father becomes an alcoholic. Her mother kind of falls apart. Is any of this analogous to real-life stories of what happened to the families that had chimps in their households?
Again, when I wrote the book, the idea I had for the book, which I credit my daughter with giving me, was that I would I had told her about the Kellogg experiment, and she was interested in the child involved. She said, "What would it be like to be that child? You should write that story." When I went out to began to do the research, I could find a lot of information about the chimps. I could find a lot of information about the studies. I could find nothing about any children who might have been in the house. You know, there would be references to children in many cases. So in many cases, I knew that there were human children in the house while these chimps were being home-raised. The Kellogg experiment is the only one I know of where they tried to twin them, but there would be older children in the house frequently. but there was just absolutely nothing. So I had to make it all up. I had to try to imagine what it would be like, which fortunately I'm a novelist. So the only one, there are two cases now where people have gotten in touch with me after the novel came out. One is this woman in the Kellogg family, and another one is a woman who now lives in Texas whose grandmother raised a number of chimps in her home for one of the labs over her childhood. And in both cases, it was pretty devastating. The woman in the Kellogg family says that it destroyed her family, although it is not at all clear to me that the destruction came from whether the destruction came from the experiment itself or whether it came from having the kind of father who would do an experiment like that. But yes, I would love to say that there are happy endings to these stories, and there are a few, but mostly not.
Yeah. Is the larger question here what it means to be human?
Absolutely. That is absolutely the larger question.
And where do you draw the line between humans and chimpanzees? Is. Or, you could talk about other animals as well.
Yes.
So where do you draw that line?
I am not sure there is a line. It's a dotted line at best. I am old enough to remember when being taught that, man was the tool using animal. So that seemed clear and firm. And now, of course, we know that all kinds of animals use tools.
And then there's the question of language.
You know, one of the difficulties is that, wherever you put the line, there are humans so damaged that they don't meet that criteria. And yet, nobody is going to argue that they're not human.
And then there are other animal species that do have language.
Yeah.
I mean, birds, for instance.
Yes. Communication.
Communication, yeah.
No, there have been some fascinating studies about, as I said, animal cognition is just moving so quickly. But, suggestions now that ground squirrels have particular signals that mean, not just danger, which we have known for a while that they can signal, that one will signal to the others that danger is coming.
I've heard that with prairie dogs.
Yes, but that they have a particular signal that means gun, that means that someone is coming with a gun. So not just danger, but gun danger. And who knows what else we will discover.
So coming back to the question then of what does it mean to be human, I mean, how do you answer that?
I put that in the category of many, many questions about the world that I cannot answer. And I think as a writer, the only questions I'm really interested in are the questions that I cannot answer, and that I reassure myself that the fact that the world is bigger and more bizarre and stranger than I will ever be able to comprehend is a good thing. And I leave it at that.
Do you think science will ever be able to answer this question?
I do not. It would break my father's heart. He was just a scientist to the core, but I have a more jaundiced idea about what studies show us. Every time I, pick up an article now and I read studies show, I think, oh, I am so sure. Oh, it would be pretty to think so.
Well, one thing that has struck me is that your novel is one of just several novels that have come out in the last few years with chimpanzees as characters.
Yes,
I mean, it seems to be this
zeitgeisty. I've been working on this novel for off and on for about 12 years. So it's interesting to think if I put it aside to do a different novel and then I put it aside to do another different novel. If I had not put it aside and it had come out in 2005, what it would have looked like and what sort of reception it would have gotten. But yeah, chimps seem to be very much in the news and on people's minds. And
so, but why? I mean, in terms of the zeitgeist, the fictional zeitgeist, why do you think this seems to be a hot subject right now?
I am guessing that, having just disparaged science thoroughly, I do find it fascinating and the particularly, as I said, I've gotten very caught up in the science of animal cognition. And there have just, you know, recently been some studies with startling findings. I don't know if you have seen or if others have paid attention, but there's a study that you can look at on YouTube from Japan of chimpanzees, and it's a short-term memory study. And what they do is they put up numerals on a computer screen, and they're there for a second at most, I think, and then they disappear, and the chimp is supposed to point, to put them in order, to point to the now blank screen, where the one was, where the two was, where the three was. And chimpanzees do this effortlessly. And then you go look at the graduate students who are trying to do the same thing, and it's impossible. It's just impossible. So I think that, Jane Goodall has certainly been a large part of this. I think that there's just been such a greater understanding, although I'm sure it's still a drop in the bucket, but we just know more and more and more about primates and about their capabilities and about their behaviors and about the our genetic connection. We now know that we share well over 90%, I think it's 96% of our genetic material entirely with chimps and
Well, and I suppose also that if consciousness is really the big subject for a novelist, trying to understand minds, you naturally will think about the mind of our closest relative, the chimpanzee.
Yes. And if in some ways the topic of a novel is always what it is like to be human, what it means to be human, then, the place to look is at non-humans, to try to see what's the same and what's different.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I've enjoyed this.